And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, a conversation about Iran with Richard Heinberg on People Rise Up. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon. My name is Andrew Geller, and it's nice to be back after a week off. We're going to be talking today about Iran. I've been talking a bit about, over the past few years, the neoconservative agenda as kind of laid out by the Project for a New American Century. We've talked about Iran. We've talked about Iraq. We're going to be talking about Iran today. And at some point, I'm sure we'll discuss events in North Korea. But Iran, in my mind, seems to be the second most important of the three countries initially mentioned as part of the Axis of Evil by George W. Bush. Just post September 11, Iraq, of course, being the first, and North Korea the other. And joining me this morning to talk about the issues connected to Iran and geopolitics and other things is journalist and author Richard Heinberg. Welcome to KBOO's airwaves, Richard.
Good to be speaking with you, Andrew.
Now, Richard has written several books regarding energy issues, industrial society, and things connected to peak oil. And all of these things kind of tie together when looking at several different countries around the world. And you wrote earlier this year, in March, an article called Onward to Iran. And it was, lengthened for publication in Nexus Magazine for their May-June issue. And it was retitled Onward to Iran and the War on Tyranny. Now, let's just set a little bit of background for folks regarding this issue. I suppose let's first discuss, where did this idea of a war on tyranny come from? Because we've all heard so much about the war on terror, and that's kind of fallen out of the vernacular of the Bush administration. So can you just explain what the war on tyranny is versus the war on terror?
Well, the phrase war on tyranny started appearing in Bush's speeches in November 2004. And he has since then, I think, slowly sort of ramped up on this theme, which is basically saying, look, what we really want to do in the Middle East and throughout the rest of the world is promote democracy. So wherever there's a tyrannical regime, then for that reason, regime change is justified. Clearly, in Iraq, the original justification for regime change was the possession of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to be the case. So retrospectively, this new justification is being applied to the regime change operation in Iraq, the real reason we went in there and had to get rid of Saddam Hussein was that he was a tyrant. And of course, since there are regimes elsewhere in the world that we don't like and that we can call tyrannical, then that will justify similar efforts elsewhere.
Now, I think that's a really important point you just made, that the United States alone is the determiner of who is tyrannical and who is not. And it really more correlates not to how leaders are placed in their positions of power in individual countries. It really seems to be more, do these countries push policies and act in a way that Washington perceives to be in its own self-interest?
Well, exactly. I mean, take a place like Venezuela, for example. I mean, here you have a leader, Hugo Chavez, who was elected overwhelmingly, and yet he is being regarded by Bush and the neoconservatives as a potential target for this war on tyranny.
And not just overwhelmingly, but repeatedly.
Yes.
So the original sort of war on terror talked only about Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, but the war on tyranny includes those countries, but also sort of unofficially lists Syria, Sudan, Algeria, Yemen, Malaysia, Somalia, Indonesia, Georgia. You could mention maybe Venezuela and possibly even other countries. Now, when we had originally scheduled this, I actually hadn't realized that Iran's presidential election would fall in between or fall before this program. A lot of people, I bet, don't have a real great grasp, detailed grasp on the history of U.S.-Iranian relations. If people know anything, it's probably connected to the 1979 hostage taking and the occupation of the U.S. embassy. So let's just back up a little bit. And if you could give us sort of a snapshot of how the U.S. and Iran, or maybe the U.S. and Western countries and Iran, interacted up to the point of the late 70s, just for some context.
Right. I think it's important to start not with the U.S., but with Great Britain, because it was in 1901 that oil, oil was discovered in Iran in 1908, but in 1901, an explorer named William Knox Darcy persuaded the Shah of Iran at that time to grant him mineral rights to the country for 60 years in exchange for 20,000 pounds and a 16% share of the profits. Now, Britain at that time was just beginning to discover the importance of oil. They were converting their war fleet from coal to oil. And so they were, because Britain didn't have any oil indigenously at that point, they began sort of surveying the horizon to see where in the world there was oil. And, of course, Britain was still at that time a great imperial power with troops stationed all over the world. So once it became clear that there was a lot of oil in Persia, the name of Iran at that time, a famous British spy was dispatched to Persia, Sidney Riley, who persuaded Darcy to part with his contract with the Shah. And out of this was born the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which would later become British Petroleum, or BP. So through various wars and intrigues over the ensuing decades, Britain managed to lose much of its influence in the country until we get to the year 1953. By that time, Iran's prime minister is a man named Mohammad Mossadegh, who was a very important person in the history of the Middle East. He was the 1951 Time magazine Man of the Year. His idea was that Iran's oil wealth should serve the people of Iran. Very strange idea, I think. And Mossadegh, of course, was not a very popular individual with British Petroleum and the American oil companies. And so in 1953, British intelligence and the CIA colluded to have Mossadegh overthrown. General Norman Schwarzkopf, who was actually the father of the Norman Schwarzkopf who led the American forces during Desert Storm in 1990, played a key role in that plot. And once Mossadegh was overthrown, the Shah took on virtually dictatorial powers, and he granted oil rights to a consortium of British and American companies and established very close ties with the U.S. So from 1953 until the late 1970s, Iran was effectively ruled by the Shah with his secret police. And a number of bits of circumstantial evidence suggest that over that time, he also gradually fell out of favor with the U.S. In 1978, he refused British Petroleum's proposal for a 25-year renewal of its oil production agreement. And the very next year, he was overthrown, of course, by the followers of Ayatollah Khomeini.
And now, this also coincides with the beginning of, the beginning of efforts to foment radical Islamic activism in the region as a means to counter the nationalistic efforts of not just in Iran, but other places as well. And I don't honestly know if there was radical Islamic political efforts ahead of then, but it certainly hadn't been to the point that it was then.
Yeah. The radical Islamist movement existed before that time, but it appears as though CIA sort of fell upon this movement as a sort of long-term strategic stroke, and the idea was to play off countries like Iran and Iraq against each other, so that the U.S. could later sort of sweep in and pick up the pieces. And of course, the radical Islamist movement played a key role in the downfall of the Soviet Union as a result of its war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And the radical Islamists at that time who were fighting against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, of course, would later morph into Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So it's radical Islam has served some interesting functions in terms of U.S. foreign policy, and one has to wonder if they're, in effect, just providing a convenient new enemy to replace the Soviet Union mm-hmm. following the end of the Cold War.
So 1979, folks take over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. 52 Americans were held for about 15 months or so, all to be released literally the hour that Ronald Reagan took the oath of office in January of 1981. The Islamic Revolution from 1979 stayed really, I guess it's still considered to be rather strong. It's never been successfully challenged from outside. The Iran-Iraq War was kind of a draw. I mean, maybe it could be viewed that Iran won, but,
In any case, 1.5 million people were killed in that war. It was immensely destructive.
And I suppose the most significant outcome from the perspective of the U.S. regarding the Iran-Iraq war was that both countries were weakened.
Yes, exactly.
So let's kind of leap ahead more to present, just to give enough time to talk about kind of what's going on now. I just want to let folks know you're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest is Richard Heinberg, author of several books, and we are discussing Iran today. You can find out more about him and his work online at www.museletter.com, and that is M-U-S-E letter.com. Now, Iran, again, part of the Axis of Evil, also said to be, and it seems, more credibly, to be developing nuclear technology. I'm not sure about weapons, but nuclear technology for sure. They say it's for peaceful purposes, and they should not be prevented from being able to do so. But then there's the dual use nature of nuclear technology, and the U.S. asserts that they, in fact, are wanting to develop nuclear weapons. And that's really the main reason that the U.S. Is, according to, is it Seymour Hersh or Scott Ritter that in January of this year said, in fact, for several months, there have been special operations commandos in Iran.
Yes, that was Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker.
Yeah, so theoretically, we've had troops there for most of a year, I imagine, you know, doing various destabilizing activities.
Well, not regular troops. We're talking about elite commando units that are operating in the country on a temporary basis.
Now, the weapons of mass destruction issue, although it seems like it could have more credibility than it did in reference to Iraq in the past few years, that doesn't really seem to me to be so urgent a reason on behalf of the United States to deal with various countries. Because if it were, we would make much greater efforts to fix the situation with North Korea, possibly several other countries. And in your article, Onward to Iran, I feel like the second reason you give is really more important, at least privately, to the leaders of the U.S. And that's that Tehran wants to open an oil stock exchange by March of 2006. Can you tell us what the oil stock exchange is about?
Yes. First, I should say that the concern over development of nuclear weapons is genuine, in that if a country like Iran does manage to develop nuclear weapons, that will give them a tremendous political leeway in the region, because they would have a credible deterrent against any other country that wished to engage in regime change, let's say. Now, on to the oil stock exchange, or the oil bourse that Iran is proposing to open. They would be selling oil, not just Iranian oil, but oil from the rest of the Middle East as well, in exchange, not just for U.S. dollars, but also euros. And this is, I think, of concern to policymakers here in the U.S., because the U.S. dollar has been the basis for the international trade of oil effectively since World War II, and formally since the mid-1970s. And this has provided the U.S. with enormous benefits, but benefits that aren't really obvious to the casual observer. If you are able to issue the world's reserve currency, that means that other countries need to have that currency. The countries of the world need U.S. dollars with which to pay for their fuel bills. If they are importing countries, they need to pay for their oil imports in U.S. dollars. If they've borrowed money from the IMF or the World Bank, they need to repay those loans with interest in U.S. dollars. So where do countries get U.S. dollars? Well, U.S. dollars are made only by U.S. banks. They can't be created by any banks anyplace else. This means that the U.S. basically has a monopoly on a scarce resource, which is U.S. dollars. And if countries want those dollars, they have to sell their goods or their manufactured products to the U.S. at discount prices in order to earn dollars for foreign exchange. Or they have to borrow more money from U.S. banks or the IMF or the World Bank. And this creates a kind of dollar dependency on the part of the rest of the world, and it creates artificial demand for the U.S. dollar, then that props up the U.S. economy and enables the U.S. to run immense trade deficits. Currently, the U.S. is borrowing on the order of $2 to $2.5 billion per day to finance its trade deficit. No other country in the world could possibly do that. The only reason the U.S. is able to do it is that the U.S. dollar is in such demand that no country is willing to sell off all of its dollar assets, even though there's effectively nothing to back up those dollars. So if Iran were in fact to open this trade oil bourse selling its oil for something other than U.S. dollars. This could begin the deflation process. This could prick the bubble and cause the dollar hegemony to unwind over the next few months. We saw something like this happen in Iraq. Iraq was actually the first country to propose selling oil for something other than U.S. dollars, which it did in November 2000. And, of course, we know what happened in that case. So I think there is genuine concern in Washington and on Wall Street about Iran's threat to open the oil bourse. And I think that's one of the reasons that Iran is a member of the Axis of Evil.
Former UN weapons inspector and former U.S. Marine Scott Ritter, I guess it was December of last year, stated that George W. Bush had already signed off on operations plans to invade Iran by the end of June 2005. Now, that's come and gone and didn't happen.
Yes.
I imagine if, in fact, his allegation is true, the reason it didn't happen is it was made public. And he could not be shown to have, credibly predicted such an event. European diplomats pretty much acknowledge that they are unable to stop the United States from military action if the United States really wants to do that. And in your article, you mentioned that they feel as though they can maybe hold out till the end of 2005. But this oil burst is really a serious issue for the U.S. If the Iranian oil stock exchange doesn't open, obviously that will, maybe not strengthen the dollar, but at least allow it to maintain its significance for a while longer. So say the oil burst doesn't open in Iran. It's not like there won't be continuing challenges to dollar hegemony regarding such a scarce resource.
Right. Yes, already I think we're seeing signs that Asian countries, particularly China and Japan, are failing to continue to increase their dollar holdings. Now, their buying of dollar-denominated debt over the last few years is what has really enabled the U.S. to run up its huge government debt and trade deficits. But now signs are that trend is tapering off. So there is going to be downward pressure on the value of the dollar over the next few months in any case. The question is whether it's going to be a real free fall in terms of dollar value. And certainly the opening of the Iranian bourse could open the door to that.
Okay, so we've just got about 5 minutes left here. The mayor of Tehran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was, at least in the eyes of the U.S. government, surprisingly elected about a week and a half ago in what a lot of media have been calling a landslide. He has adopted a stridently defiant position regarding the West, while at the same time saying he would like to engage the West, but he will not have Iranian politics follow what the West wants to do, and that they are going to be an independent and culturally appropriate administration for their own country, working for the people there. It doesn't seem like Ahmadinejad's election is in any way going to simplify resolution of this conflict.
No, not at all. Ahmadinejad is culturally very conservative, and no friend of the U.S., but economically, he's, I think, what could only be called a socialist. He wants to see Iranian oil income distributed more to the people of Iran and more economic equality within the country and so on. None of this, of course, endears him to U.S. policymakers, and, of course, there was even the floating of the idea that he might have been one of the hostage takers back in 1979. I think that idea has been pretty much discredited by now, although I think there are some lingering questions. questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
So one can almost see the process occurring in real time in Washington of trying out various scenarios and excuses, if you will, for taking a harder and harder line against Iran, and so that the American people will be prepared when, in fact, the time comes for military strikes on Iranian weapons facilities and perhaps even an invasion. Although I think as time goes on, the full invasion option becomes less and less likely simply because the U.S. is so overstretched in Iraq. I think the more likely scenario would be airstrikes, possibly by Israel, that would then open the way to U.S. strikes as well.
Right. And last fall, the Atlantic Magazine had a war games think tank that you reference in your article. And there were three most likely scenarios were fully played out. And the retired Air Force colonel who led the war games summarized that group's conclusion by saying, quote, "You have no military solution for the issues of Iran, and you have to make diplomacy work." And so this is not like left policy analyst. This is a retired Air Force colonel that leads war games saying this is not the way to go.
Yes. Somebody else who was involved in those war games, however, also said you can never assume that just because a government knows something is unviable, it won't go ahead and do it anyway.
Right. Right. That's Thomas Hams. And I actually like the quote you referenced from Michael Mazar, a professional of national security strategy at the National War College. Again, not someone outside of the military. Quote, "Companies deciding which kinds of toothpaste to market have much more rigorous established decision-making procedures to refer to than the most senior officials of the U.S. government deciding whether or not to go to war." And that's the end of that quote. And we certainly saw that regarding Iraq and hopefully not regarding Iran.
Yes.
Well, we are basically out of time, and unfortunately things go by too quickly sometimes here on the show. This is just something that's going to kind of be open-ended, and we'll just have to keep alert and watch. Any suggested good news websites people could refer to find accurate information about this subject?
Actually, I don't have a specific one on this subject. Yeah. As you know, my particular field of interest is in global petroleum supplies, and for energy news in that regard, I think the best site is energybulletin.net.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually didn't have any either, and that's why I asked you. Well, Richard Heinberg has been my guest this morning. You can find out more about him, his work, and find out about the many books he has written online at www.museletter.com, and that's M-U-S-E-L-E-T-T-E-R. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
All right. Take care. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has more information regarding Iran, the war on tyranny versus the war on terror, and links to a couple of other places where you can find some more information about the newly elected president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. If you'd like to contact me, you can send email to kboo@riseup.net. You can also send me postal mail here, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.